It's Friday again. That means it's time for Free Thoughts with Bowen and Twyman. And I'm your co-host, Mike Bowen.
And I'm the co-host, Wink Twyman. Welcome aboard. Looking forward to another great conversation.
Today, we're going to talk about a very popular subject, which is movies. And we're going to talk about a little bit about black film. And we're going to put some stakes in the ground about some references for actors, directors, subjects, and the things that we love about movies and some of the things we don't like so much. And then, of course, we'll blackify this. We'll put in the flavor because we'll talk a little bit more about black movies and plays. Mm-hmm. And so Wink came up with a brilliant idea. And since he's the deep one and I'm the broad one, he's going to tell us something about Lorraine Hansberry.
Oh, yes. So for those who may not be aware, for those who've been under a rock for the past 40, 50 years, Lorraine Hansberry was a brilliant playwright from the city of Chicago. I believe her father was a real estate investor, and her family was quite active on the south side of Chicago, particularly in civil rights and redlining desegregation. But she really made her mark, and I believe the date was March 10th. It sounds right, March 10th, 1959, when her Broadway play, A Raisin in the Sun, debuted. And it was said that people wanted to clap forever, for eternity. It was a brilliant exposition of truth, of the human condition, set in a working-class black family home in the south side of Chicago. Every family wants something. And this family wanted to live in a better house. They had other wants as well. They wanted family peace. They wanted money. The protagonist, Walter Younger, wanted to buy and invest in a liquor store. His sister wanted to become a doctor. Everyone has something they wanted. But primarily, they wanted to live in a nice house outside of the ghetto in South Chicago.
And so this is kind of like a classic American dream story.
Of course. Yes, definitely. Definitely. And I think people received it so well in 1959 because it was devoid of caricatures and stereotypes. You know, there wasn't the mammy figure. There wasn't the minstrel figure. There wasn't the tragic mulatto figure. It was truly real life on the streets in a typical family. The sort of family that Lorraine Hansberry probably had met in various formulations growing up in the south side of Chicago. Yeah. But I love this play so much, which became a movie in 1961, because it reminds us that one can live in a black family, but yet the things that drive people, the motivations of people are just universal, and it's the universality of those motivations that can really captivate an audience, and certainly me. I spent the past 2 hours before we started this broadcast briefly watching A Raisin in the Sun, and it was just so captivating, Michael, I tell you. I mean, it's in black and white, of course. You know, it's before the internet, before cell phones, but it didn't matter because you could see, you could feel the life, the emotion, the struggle, the heartbreak, the adversity, the triumph. There's this marvelous scene where Walter Younger, who's the protagonist, he works as a chauffeur, and yes, it's his dream to own a liquor store. And he's got two buddies. They may or may not be shady, but all he's got to do is put in $10,000, and then he can have his share at the liquor store.
That's all it takes.
Vic Walter's father passed away, and his legacy was a $10,000 insurance check to the family. Mm. So the question is, will the family put it all on the liquor store as Walter wants, or will the mother actually put it on a new, better house outside of the ghetto in the south side of Chicago? Or will she put some of that money on the education for the future? As I mentioned before, Walter's sister, her dream in life is to become a doctor. And I love that so much, not just because in the 1950s, you know, people are thinking in those ways, But I love it so much because even though she wants to be a doctor, and one would think that's a very bougie thing to want to do in 1959, like E. Franklin Frazier's The Black Bourgeoisie, she's the opposite of that, of a bougie person, if you recall, Michael. She as she says, she is anti-assimilation.
Yes.
She falls for this African guy over this rich Black American dude.
Yes.
He gives her an African garb to wear. She starts dancing African music. She trumpets her ties to Nigeria. That's
no, but
she
the real big thing to let you know is she cuts off her perm. She cuts off her perm and comes out with the afro.
That's interesting.
In 1959.
Right,
that's
right,
saying something.
Exactly.
That's very interesting. I looked at the spark notes of this, and I was the kid that memorized the poem from, you know, What Happens to a Dream Deferred.
Do you still have it memorized?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay,
unfortunately.
Okay. That would have been wonderful audience, dear audience, and Michael could at my heart remember that. So,
yeah,
oh, well.
I know. But, you know, I was a little bit on the different side of that in terms of the dreams. That would have been maybe my grandfather's generation would have gone through that story.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing to this, as I'm reading it again, I'm thinking about how it compares to people, you know, who we were in the 80s or 90s and who Americans are now, and Black American dreams. And it's really amazing to see how much the influence of the native-born African had on Benitha, the character who wanted to be a doctor.
Oh, it is. It is.
And it's really something. And you and also the extent to which Mama is a Christian who's not going to have any cursing in her house.
That's right. That's right.
Just like you, it's another generation. Clearly, and still it's timeless because it talks about, you know, what is my ambition? Mm-hmm. I feel like I can't be the man of the house. And certainly views towards women have changed about, you know, what is proper for a woman to do. And then the idea that that Walter's wife might consider not bearing that second child.
I know. Big Mama, wow. Yes, that just killed her. That just devastated her. Yes,
yeah.
I was surprised to see that on the screen in 1961. And another way that things change, and you may remember this, or not from the notes you're reading, but at one point George comes by. George is the well-to-do Black American who doesn't excite Walter's sister whatsoever. But anyway, he's a college kid. He's in some fraternity, and he's wearing like the fancy dancy white shoes of the day. And Walter repeatedly makes fun of his shoes and says, and I will use the words because they're from 1950, those faggoty shoes, faggoty shoes you're wearing, get those faggoty. And I just thought that's an example of how much things have changed, right?
Truly.
Since the 1950s.
Truly.
You would not have a character using those terms in the year 2024.
But certainly I remember one of my favorite writers, Marcus Mabry, wrote his life story called White Bucks and Black Eyed Peas.
Oh.
So I'm sure that he had gone through that. I believe he went to Stanford. And so that would have been one of the college boys. And he did well. He became a major editor in a New York publication that we've all heard of.
Yeah. But great, Michael, if I can make the link, what's so great about A Raisin in the Sun is it ties nicely to American Fiction, which is this season's brouhaha. Because
I see what you did there.
You get to time travel and see what happened to the children and grandchildren of the younger family. Because remember, the sister wanted to become a doctor. Well, in American Fiction, everyone's a doctor, almost. right?
Yeah.
Lisa's a doctor. Lisa Ellison. Cliff is a doctor, a plastic surgeon in Tucson. Dad was a doctor, although he's no longer in the picture. And even Monk Ellison is a doctor, albeit a PhD, not a medical doctor. So my point is, it was a marvelous, if you will, treadmill or escalator from the 1959 play to 2024. So what happens to the children and grandchildren of the people for whom becoming a doctor was the great North Star. What happens when those people are in their middle age and they're living in Boston with the summer home at the beach? And what issues do they face in terms of?
But then again, and it's kind of the same story. What happens when a family member dies, and how do things change, and where does it leave, you know, the kids, and how do they deal with it?
Now, what's deep is you're referring to the dad, correct? The father,
the father, died?
Yes, yes,
correct.
Who committed suicide, I believe.
Yes,
yes,
that's right.
Yes, and you know that's very uncommon. You don't normally see examples on the silver screen of Black suicides, if I'm correct.
Can you think of
another
don't.
Example in any movie where you've seen a Black suicide?
Oh, geez.
I can't think of one.
Yeah, it's nothing on the list that I have here.
Right. It's very uncommon. I mean, yes.
Yeah, those things are.
To give you an example, and this is a sad story, but it's a truthful story to give the example. So years and years ago, when I was working in another place, one of my colleagues, he's a great guy, but he had the unfortunate... he made some poor choices, let's just say, during a lawsuit, and he was an attorney. He was a married guy. He developed an affection for the paralegal in the opposing team. And so they started to have, like, sex on the desk, toying recess in the litigation. And that's just not
That's right. Approaching the bench.
That's approaching ethical violations. Wait, so anyway, but long and short of it is, he actually could not withstand the social stigma of that and, you know, reputational harm, and he actually did commit suicide. But I remember telling a friend that story, and she looked at me, and she was puzzled, and she said, "Wink, that's odd, because Black people don't commit suicide." Well, number one, she assumed he was Black. He wasn't. Which is another thing we could talk. And number two, maybe there's something to the fact that it's so uncommon in our generation in certain circles. But that's a point, is that people tend to assume when you're talking about life and it's another Black person, we must be talking about a Black person unless you make their race clear as a descriptor. You know
very I mean? Interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So in American fiction, It's strange. I wasn't prepared to really look at it as a race movie, but it is kind of a race movie. You know, it's done in an interesting place. I mean, I thought it was not melodramatic. I say that it is kind of melodramatic comedy, because there's lighthearted parts of it and there's laugh out loud parts of it, and especially the end. And so in a way, that is a great way to do race movies that has basically been broken through that through Key and Peele. I think the Key and Peele show was a little bit too racy for me. I was like, you guys are getting kind of heavy-handed every once in a while, but then they had enough humor so that you're like, okay, that's actually kind of funny. But they've gone beyond that, and you see what their films are now. This is an extraordinary kind of thing. So I'm willing to say, okay, this is a kind of a race movie, but it's very different from the kinds of race movies that we've seen before in the past. Number one, because of class.
Right.
But number two, because it even does the heavy-handed stuff in a parody kind of fashion.
Yeah.
In the way that does it. Yeah. So that's what made it really attractive to me.
But here's
I didn't think question. It was a great movie, but very good movie.
And as some people may know, I adore American fiction. I am ready to take this forward and to trumpet its cause. But Michael, a question to you. You used the phrase a race movie, am I correct? A Black movie?
Yes.
Race movie?
Yes.
Okay. Pick
and that's different than a Black movie.
Oh, okay. So yes. What makes the movie a race movie? Let's define.
All right, I'll give you an example.
Okay. Yeah.
So let's look at Denzel Washington.
Love him.
All right, Denzel Washington has done several movies that I love. I mean, I'm as big a fan as you can be of Denzel without being a little bit over the edge. So consider Soldier's Story.
Yes.
Now, Soldier Story is a race movie.
Why?
Because it talks about how Sergeant Waters criticizes the behavior of the other blacks because there's white people looking.
Okay, fair.
And then he tells that poor kid, you know, the Negro race does not have a place for you, cotton picking, guitar strumming, joking person. And then Denzel's character comes to his defense and says, oh, and then Sarge is like, oh, you're just going to be like that now. He says, you don't have to insult him like that. It is really an interesting microcosm of various black personalities in the segregated army, which is the subtext of the whole thing, and how they're going to conduct themselves.
Was the actor named Alfonso or Adolf Caesar?
Adolf Caesar, yes. Yep, something like it. Yep. That was Sergeant Waters.
When I saw him, he just looks like a typical Twyman uncle. All of my uncles look like that guy.
And they have that crazy guy. And that's interesting.
That's where I come from. That's where I come from.
Adolf, he was also in the original movie, The Color Purple. He was Mr.'s father.
Yeah.
When Whoopi Goldberg was going to shave his neck on the sun porch.
Right.
Oh, that was dramatic.
Right. Now, so, Michael,
Go ahead.
Name me a movie which Denzel was in, Denzel Washington, which was not a race movie.
Okay. That's easy. That one of my favorites, The Book of Eli.
I've never seen that.
Oh, my goodness. The Book of Eli is a post-apocalyptic movie where Denzel Washington is kind of like a blind samurai.
Oh.
He survives the nuclear winter, and he's blinded by this.
Right.
And then he is on a mission. And so he's on a trek, and he's trying to get to this place. And in his possession is a book. And most books have been destroyed. And so he comes across this town where, you know, the bad guy has taken over. He's the mobster. He's the gangster. But he realizes that Eli has this book. And from this book, there is knowledge and wisdom that could be spread. And he could make a religion out of that. And he could make himself the cult figure.
I like
but
that.
Also, as a blind samurai, Denzel's character is a badass. And so you just do not want to mess with him. And, you know, he goes through the whole thing. You really don't want to fight me, son. But to give this one away, because even though I give it away, it's still an excellent movie, always worth your time.
Right.
He's actually carrying one of the last printed Bibles.
That's interesting.
And his trek is to get all the way to the island of Alcatraz, where they're trying to rebuild civilization, and they have all those sacred texts.
I see.
That is not a race movie. It's a Denzel Washington film. And we're very fortunate, you know, even if there's not 40 million books and novels written, it was kind of what we wanted from Denzel. Is kind of what we wanted from Michael Jordan, which was to stand up and be all those characters, portray all those characters instead of just these narrow set of characters. Give us a bunch of different heroes and maybe even an anti-hero to cheer for. And that is why American film wouldn't be what it is today without Denzel playing all of those different characters. Another one of my favorites is Man on Fire, where he plays an ex-CIA agent who's befriended by another one. I think I can't remember his name, but he's the guy who was in the Kings of New York, and he was in the Super Bowl halftime show. Right. And he's got this voice that everybody likes to do. I'm sorry for blanking that, but everybody knows who I'm talking about. And they're these old guys that says, you know, what we've done, God will not forgive us. And he's called to be a bodyguard for this rich family's daughter. And he's just dark, brooding.
Gotcha.
And he's playing with the bullet. So he's thinking about putting that to his head through this whole thing because he doesn't know if he can be redeemed. And that's just a subtle, beautiful
I love it.
Film.
I love it.
Which is dark and action-packed and bloody as well.
What about Shawshank Redemption, Morgan Freeman? Was that a race movie or not?
No, I didn't think so. I didn't think so. And nor was Seven, which was a great movie of his. But you know, to a slight point, one of my favorite roles was him in Deep Impact, which was when we were doing all the Armageddon. Armageddon was the other film.
Yeah.
And he plays the president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And there has never been a more dignified, upstanding, I want to follow this guy than Morgan Freeman as president of the United States during this crisis where they're like going to have to march people underground and live there if these boulders fall from the sky. So he's actually the guy you want to listen to when the literal sky is falling. That was Morgan Freeman.
I love this review. I love this journey because contrary to what Monk Ellison says at one point in American Fiction, I think he's talking to his publisher or his agent rather. And the agent says, well, you're looking for something black. Well, I'm black. My book is black. But you're making the point that just because you're the black protagonist or main character doesn't make it a race movie.
That's right. That's right.
And it doesn't make it a black movie.
No, it doesn't.
Gotcha.
It doesn't.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. Independence Day, Will Smith, race movie or not?
No.
Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha.
But it's interesting because the biggest cheer of that, the two biggest cheers of that movie were the one where the White House gets destroyed.
Yes.
Right? And the second one, when Will Smith socks the alien and says, "Welcome to America, bitch," and that was just great. That was just great. And Will Smith, you know, he has done something very good to update George, the suburban college kid, because Will Smith always played, you know, the clean cut. I'm suburban.
Yeah,
I can do stuff. You know, parents just don't understand. I mean, that's a middle class suburban complaint, and he turned it into a rap song. So he can get kind of silly sometimes, but I like what Will Smith has done to add to black diversity.
What about his movie Degrees of Separation? 6 Degrees of Separation? Is that a race movie?
It was.
Why was that a race movie?
Well, because he was fronting, right?
He was fronting, quote unquote, just as some generic Ivy League kid.
I would compare that to The Talented Mr. Ripley. All right. Where you're pretending to be somebody you're not.
Right.
And what was the other one? Isn't there another Prince and the Pauper story, Brideshead Revisited?
Okay, I never saw it.
Okay, so that's the classic where you have kind of a prince and a pauper, and the princely one takes a shining to the other one, and the other one is trying to ape all of the upper class, mannerisms. And I haven't seen Brideshead Revisited, but I do remember that's part of the plot. But this is the Upper West Side with white liberals who are hand over foot taken in by this young black person.
But he could have been a young white person.
He could have been.
It wasn't a race movie.
Maybe I just had race too much in my head when I saw it. And I was like, let's see if I could get over doing something like that.
I'm just pushing back a little, right?
Okay, all right. That's fair. That's absolutely fair. That's absolutely fair.
Let's try another one that's a little on the edge. How about Pursuit of Happiness? Race movie or not?
Pursuit of Happiness. That's kind of a feel-good movie. Kind of, you can do it if you try.
Will Smith.
It's an American dream. Yes, it's an American dream kind of movie.
That doesn't make it a race movie.
No, though. I don't. I wouldn't necessarily say that's a race movie.
Gotcha.
But I know that lots of people in audiences would take it as, oh, that's a role model. Isn't it good to see him do this role model?
But you can be a role model and not be racialized, right?
Yes, I agree. I agree. I wouldn't call that much of a race movie.
If I think about it, I don't think the word race or black was uttered once in that movie.
Not likely. I don't think so. I don't think so.
Yeah, yeah.
So first of all, I think we should take a moment to mourn the passing just today, as we're recording this, of the great Lou Gossett Jr.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
And he, I don't think he did any race movies, but man, oh man, was I glad to see him do what he did in Officer and a Gentleman.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That was fantastic.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I love these old school kid. Yeah.
And Raising in the Sun. He was the little kid, I think. No. He was George. He was George, the rich black American. He was
really
George. Look at it again. Look at the face.
Oh, I'm gonna have to go see that now. Now I absolutely did.
That's right. That's right.
Oh my goodness. Cause I mean, I just saw a clip with Sidney Poitier and I'm like, oh, this is good.
Yeah.
Sidney's playing this angry black man, which is the thing that, you know, most people didn't expect that he would do.
Mm.
But then again, the defiant ones, that was good. And
sure.
Was his called? No, that wasn't Two Mules for Sister Sarah, but there was another movie where he, Poitier plays a carpenter.
Lilies of the Field or something like that.
Lilies of the Field. That's the one.
Yeah. Yes. The nuns are in that. Yeah. I love that.
Extraordinary. What a great movie.
And
great.
They don't
make movies like, no, not a race movie.
Nope.
Not one of those. They don't make films like that with blue collar heroes much anymore.
It's true. Now I'm going to challenge your noggin a little bit here. How about the one, the only Pulp Fiction race movie or not?
Pulp Fiction, oh my God.
I don't know. Think about it.
No. I don't think it's a race movie. I don't think it is. It's not.
Why do you say that?
Because Marcellus Wallace was, oh God, I'm so tempted just to quote lines from the movie.
Do it. The audience said do it.
Do you know who this is? It's Marcellus Wallace. Does he look like a bitch to you? No, he does not look like a bitch. Oh, that's great. Yes. Thinking about movies, I love Tarantino.
Yes.
He's one of my favorite directors.
Known for race movies, by the way.
But he did do The Hateful Eight.
Yes.
And The Hateful Eight is a great trickster moment, and it is racialized certainly, because it's an appropriate period piece.
Yeah.
All right. So a lot of the tension in that is from race.
Yeah.
And Django Unchained. I mean,
of course, obviously,
that's
right. Yeah.
That's right. It.
Yeah. It defines itself.
But I think if you I watched the other one, the 70s one. I think that was Pam Grier in it, and I'd have to look those up, but that one didn't strike me as a race movie, even though it was kind of a 70s. It was kind of a blaxploitation caper film.
Gotcha.
And it's interesting. I don't think some blaxploitation movies were race movies and some were not.
Oh, which ones were not?
So you could see, for example, take A Rage in Harlem.
Okay.
All right? That's a black cast movie that probably had some race things in it, but that wasn't the point.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't one of the points that was trying to be driven home. Or Coming to America.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another black cast movie.
Yeah.
But it wasn't trying to bring home some kind of point about race in America.
How about Cleopatra? Was that a race movie?
Oh, God. That's a first world problem. I'm not even...
Well, no. Wait, you can't get on that easy. You can't get on that easy, right? I mean, if you use your own definition, try to make a point.
No, I
harder to make a
point in Cleopatra. I don't know if there's a more recent Cleopatra than the classic one, which was never particularly interesting to me. I mean, mm-hmm. I love the Ten Commandments, and yeah. I would quote those. I think I actually have quoted that. And right, here is one for you, Free Thoughts fans. In which episode did I quote something from the Ten Commandments? The first person who puts it in the comment section, we're gonna quote. We're gonna give you a free subscription to Free Black Thought.
All right, guys,
we're gonna comp you for a year.
That's right. There you go. Line up and take right. chances. So yeah. I find this whole thing fascinating. When is a movie a race movie and when is it not? And I find it fascinating because, as you know, I love science fiction. I love the Twilight Zone and the original Star Trek. And you see Black actors in these series.
Yes.
But you never come away thinking it's a race episode or a race scene. Not the closest I can. Well, no, there was one race episode in the Twilight Zone. It's the one which I have as a link that touched the Russian novelist, where the Black minister is talking about darkness coming over the land and the need for people to be up front with the darkness of prejudice. That was clearly a race episode. But other than that, you'd have a Black psychiatrist in a scene, a Black doctor in a scene, a Black bartender. You would have a Black boxer. You would have a Black judge. And you never had the sense it was a race episode or a race scene. And keep in mind, that's the 1950s. You're talking 59 to 64, where right. Rod Serling is having Black people in these positions of authority and respect. But you never had the sense it was a race episode.
Yes, but then there would be characters who would necessarily be dignified. And that was something that was considered new and different. That they wouldn't be lower class or impoverished or something like that. I mean, I don't even remember Old Yeller, but something tells me that if that was a Black story, you know, it was be, oh, let's feel sorry for these poor unfortunates.
Oh, that's a deep point. Are you suggesting, Michael, that by Rod Serling consciously going against caricatures and stereotypes,
yes,
he had a racial point and that made it a race episode? That's a deep point you're
coming. Yeah. Well, there was a race episode in which I think Captain Kirk kisses Uhura. And that was a major point.
Because that's the point of the episode.
Yes.
I buy it. Even though no one articulated it in the scene, in the episode, no one's saying, oh my God, she's Black and he's white. And what's the... Right. It was totally in the mind of the viewer. Yeah, totally. Totally.
But now I'm going to, since I've written these down, I'm going to talk to very explicit race movies.
Do it.
First and foremost, an obvious Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. Okay. Obviously, Black versus Italian. And then the scene in which Turturro just starts spewing out all the stereotypes. Oh man, that was great.
Yeah.
Number two, I'm saying American Fiction is a race movie.
Okay.
Number three that I really enjoyed, but was also very uplifting, was Aquila and the Bee.
No, I never saw that. Give me a quick
Aquila overview. And the Bee is like super wholesome movie about a young kid, a little girl named Aquila, who is encouraged by her teacher to stand up and do the spelling bee.
Okay, I think I've heard of this. Yeah,
and it's just marvel. It's a marvel. Absolutely, get your kids to go see that one.
Right,
But the equivalent for us way back in the 70s was Brian's Song.
Yes.
Do you remember that movie, Brian's Song?
You know what's
about
so
Gale
sad?
Sayers?
What's so sad is, yes, I think that was a race movie, but it felt so transcendent. And it feels kind of icky to label it as a race movie, but it was, given your definition, right?
And it was about, you know, presaging Rodney King. Right. Can't we all just get along? And then, of course, the most triumphant of them all would be Remember the Titans. With Denzel Washington again.
Pound the table, pound the table.
That's number one.
I'm going to give you a little internal footnote here as one of my Substack essays. I am so, so annoyed that the powers that be in Alexandria, Virginia changed the name of T.C. Williams High School. Yes, they did, Michael. Yes, they did. Let the word go forth through the land on this podcast. They changed it because T.C. Williams happened to be, back in the day of our grandparents, a lock the door, save the kids.
And now we'll never know.
Michael, if you lived in Virginia in the 1920s, 30s, or 40s.
Well, I guess
was an integrationist, right? So you have to look at these historical characters as whole people.
Yeah.
To me, that name, T.C. Williams High School, is so emblematic of the New South. It is such a stirring example of the white and black separate worlds crumbling, of a football team coming together across the color line. Denzel Washington shows us in the movie. Why couldn't they just leave the name alone, Michael?
I have a conspiracy theory about that.
What's your conspiracy theory?
Well, okay, so this is actually a provocative conjecture.
Sure.
And the provocative conjecture is, take all of the angry tweets on Twitter for the past 3 months, especially in Black History Month.
Right.
And let that be the basis for the history curricula of America. And it'll come down to about 15 or 20 books, 7 or 8 movies, and that'll be it. To the exclusion of everything else of the truth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
because, you know, when you politicize Black history or Black people, then you're always about, well, this is my political view and it should win right now. And everybody else should lose.
I'm gonna this is my last point. I think we lose something in terms of our racial psychology when we erase and delete these names that meant so much to a generation of Southern kids that were doing the divine good work of creating an integrated society. And that's all I'm gonna say.
It shouldn't all go down to the memory hole.
Right.
So here are 3 race movies that were horrible.
Okay.
The first one was so bad that I didn't even bother to watch it.
Cleopatra. I'm just teasing.
Crash. So this came out in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And it was the people who were raving about it, that's the ones I was like, oh, if you liked it, I know I'm not going to like it, but you know, I was in a different world in the early 90s, but oh my God, so bad.
What was the point of Crash? Was there a point?
I refuse to even pay attention to
it. Okay, that's fair.
It's just like everybody, every time, it's, put it this way.
Right.
It's like Soul Plane. That's how I looked at it.
Okay, gotcha.
I'm like, I don't even want to watch the trailer for this.
Gotcha.
It's such an insult to my intelligence.
I understood.
Okay,
understood.
And the next one was Bamboozled.
Okay, now let's talk, Michael. Let's talk.
All right.
Now, okay. It's creative. I grant you that. It's a little bit unconventional. I grant you that. But the thing about Bamboozled is, it did kind of take you to dark places, and slightly crania is mine. And it made you think. You didn't have to like accept it or agree with it, but it made you think. And if it makes you think, doesn't that kind of rescue it from the abyss of bad race movies if it makes you think? What do you think?
I think if that made you think, it means you've never thought before.
No, that's an easy critique of Bamboozle.
Well, my critique here is
for our audience, so that our audience knows what is this movie about, Bamboozle. So that people.
Oh my God! So I believe it was the black equivalent of Springtime for Hitler.
Ooh, that's
so.
Deep. That's harsh.
So they basically says. That's let's harsh. Make a play on Broadway where we actually do tap dancing in blackface and we do all this stuff. And then it becomes this smash hit and the guy makes all kinds of money.
Right.
I'm like, first of all, this is such a dead ripoff. Secondly, the acting is horrible. And okay. I don't know where this guy came up with this accent. The guy played by one of the Wayans brothers.
Where the
hell did that come from? It was just yeah. So that was ham handed.
Okay.
Spike Lee has done better.
You've beaten me down, Michael. I'm not gonna say another thing. You've beaten
all right,
me down.
Now here's the all time worst of the worst, right. And that would be Bullworth.
Yeah, that's kind of bad.
Yeah. So nothing further needs to be said about that.
Yeah, that's I think that's enough.
So Wink, who are some of your favorite black actors?
You know, I'm glad you asked me that question because I'm going to be honest with you and my readers and viewers know this already. I'm not the quote unquote hyper black person when it comes to movies and viewership. So I don't always think about things in terms of if the movie is a race movie or not, or a black movie or not. Sometimes I care, but to be honest, totally honest, I'm burying my soul, people, I really don't care a lot of the time. But because I knew the question was coming, I decided to quickly pull from my grab bag, Santa's bag, my favorite black actors and situations. So this may surprise you, Michael, but it's true.
Oh, okay, let's go.
So number one, and it's not a movie, but it's like a series. Do you ever watch Black Mirror?
Oh, yeah.
It's dark.
Black Mirror, yes.
I love the character in season 3, episode 4. It's San Junipero. It's when the people come back to life, when they die.
Oh, yeah.
I love the character Kelly. And Kelly, I think her real name is Gugu, or G-U-G-U. Batha Ray, I'm sure I slandered her name, but calling a South African doctor, mom is an English nurse, and I just love her accent. I love her presence on the screen. I love that character, Kelly. I dig that. That's the key in my mind, number one.
Good one.
Yeah. Number two, and this will surprise you, since you know things like Rod Sterling and...
I do.
Walker. But number two that came to mind is the one and the only Michael Kenneth Williams, who played Omar Little in The Wire.
Okay.
Or who carried the shotgun.
Well, speaking of odd taste, I'm one of those people who never watched The Wire.
Oh, well, then, you know, we can't. You know, the world has two types of people. So for our audience listeners who have watched The Wire, you will appreciate how odd it is that Wink, Mr. Southern suburban small town kid, loves a stick-up guy. Basically, Omar's a stick-up man in the world of Baltimore, and he's very dramatic. He's very principled. He's a moral stick-up man.
Yeah, I think I remember which one Omar was. I'm seeing him in a penthouse. And he's cursing at his flunkies for doing something stupid.
No, that may not be Omar. That may be the English actor. How do you pronounce his name?
Idris Elba?
Yeah. I think that's Idris. The guy you're thinking of. No, Omar's more street than that. Omar has to the penthouse level.
All right.
Lives in the trap house, shall we say. He very much
lives
on the ground level.
Gotcha.
And, so guilty pleasure, Omar Little. And third, who's my third pick? Of course, the one and the only, Nichelle Nichols, who plays Lieutenant Uhura.
of course.
Nichelle Nichols. There's somebody. Oh, is she still with us? I don't remember.
I hope so. I think so.
Okay.
But I know that I think she had dementia.
Diagnosed
20 years ago, maybe?
It actually happens that an old classmate of mine became a Hollywood producer. And he has put together a biopic of Nichelle Nichols. And there are extraordinary things about her that you wouldn't guess, even if you just said, you know, she's a role model of role models.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, Nichelle Nichols went to the head of NASA and said, you know who I am, right? You know how many people love me, right?
Right.
And we therefore have black astronauts because of her influence.
Well, that's good.
And
that's
every important. One of them says, Lieutenant Uhura was my role model growing
that's
up. Good. And I'm so glad because she did actually play an active role in changing hearts and minds at NASA.
Mm-hmm. Love her. Great actress. Yeah. So those are my three picks that come to mind.
So let's tangent off of Idris Elba. Because we've been talking about Nigerians.
Yes,
and of course, since I had my 23andMe, I now know that I am 1/8. I am 17% North Nigerian, and I found out that it's the Fon tribe, F-O-N, are the ones that look the most like me and my cousins and everybody on my dad's side of the family.
Join the crowd.
Yes, so three actors that we should all know. And of course, my favorite, Chiwetel Ejiofor. And Chiwetel Ejiofor is best known for his role in 12 Years a Slave.
Oh, yeah, I love that. Yeah, I love that.
But
actor,
that guy, I actually haven't seen that because I don't like slavery movies.
I'm just kidding.
He was also excellent in Inside Man, Spike Lee's movie. It was one of Spike Lee's best movies, starring Denzel Washington, a caper film, and he was the assistant to Denzel. So, smashing. And of course, anybody who's a fan of Firefly knows the film Serenity, and he was the bad guy in Serenity. Oh, he was so good. Yeah, he has a samurai sword. So, great actor.
Good.
Number two, Nigerian actor from the UK. David Oyelowo.
Okay.
All right. And he's the guy who played Bass Reeves in the recent series. Extraordinarily good actor. Just sometimes you watch a movie and we're supposed to look at their face because they're not given any good dialogue. And you're like, oh, this is horrible. This is a horrible movie. But a great actor can make you feel all kinds of things just by their expression, just by the way they carry themselves. And David O is the man when it comes to that. And again, mastering the accents is a great thing. Then we have John Boyega. And John Boyega is demonstrating his range. He's still a young guy, but he did Attack the Block, which was a hilarious B-movie that you just got to see, a cult guilty pleasure. Of course, we know him from Star Wars and his most recent farce, which is They Cloned Tyrone. So some great actors. But I also have to give props, you know, to the classics, and we've already talked about Lou Gossett, Denzel Washington.
Yes.
That leaves two more top billers. And I think it could be controversial. First of all, Samuel L. Jackson.
Why is he controversial?
What do you think about Sam Jackson?
Well, Pulp Fiction. I mean, he was masterwork. I mean, from Pulp Fiction, with Samuel Jackson, you really can't go anywhere but down. I mean, that was kind of the epitome, I think, of an acting. You were in the room, literally, as he's talking with the guy eating his burger.
I'm not going to say what again. I kind of want a big Kahuna burger. I kind of want to know what that tastes like. I was like, ooh. So my favorite Sam Jackson movies.
Yeah.
And I think where he does a great job is The Negotiator. That's a great movie. And then when he plays against Type in The Red Violin, where he's an art dealer. But I think his best movie ever that is prime grade A number one Sam Jackson is Unthinkable.
Oh, okay.
Have you seen that one?
I'm not sure. I may not have.
All right, so he's also done Unbreakable, which was co-starring with Bruce Willis.
Yes.
Where Sam Jackson is the bad guy. He's Mr. Glass because bones break. But he's a tortured genius as a bad guy, and he's very good in that role. Mm-hmm. But Unthinkable is he's basically a negotiator on the knock list. I mean, he's just like one of those secret agents that they pull out they find the guy who knows where the nuclear terrorist bomb is, and this guy has to get it out of him. So he's like one of those guys who's got the heart medicines and he crunches them in his mouth. And he's hard as nails in this, and it's a great moral drama.
What do you suggest would be controversial?
He plays against Carrie Ann Moss, who we know as Trinity from The Matrix.
Oh, okay.
I love Sam Jackson.
Yeah, I
love Sam Jackson because, to me, he kind of represents the American male that gets all the bad rap. He's totally unleashed. He's completely free. He makes huge amounts of money. He's you really have to think about how you write for Sam Jackson.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know how much he improvises what he says. But more than any other actor, I think he gets away with whatever he wants to do.
Did you like his role in Django?
Oh, that was brilliant. That was brilliant.
Yeah.
I recently read that they really had to cut back on what he was saying.
Oh.
In that the original dialogue has so many N-bombs. Mm-hmm. And so many, the only thing I think that stayed in the movie is, what's that nigga doing up on a horse? I think that's the only one that stayed. But the rest was just like so, that had the potential to be greater than great. Mm. That's something that we don't see in film so much, is like class or regional conflicts between black protagonists.
Oh, that's true. That's a good point.
Where you really get to hear what people really say and what people really think. That's the kind of the airing dirty laundry that nobody can really handle.
Although we did see a 1950 versions of it in A Raisin in the Sun. I mean, the youngers were coming at it. They were unplugged. For the 1950s, they were unplugged.
Yes, I agree. The Cosby Show never got that deep.
Right. Oh, is Cosby your last person or not?
No. Actually, my last favorite actor is Forrest Whitaker.
Oh, I love him. He's great. He's good.
Yes.
I just the Last King of Scotland.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Absolutely. Great. Absolutely. Great. I have that. That's right here. That and Ghost Dog. It's brilliant. Nobody else could have done it.
That's true.
Else could have done it. He was absolutely, absolutely brilliant. We're the same age.
Oh, really?
And, okay. Yeah, and he went to high school with my sister-in-law.
Okay. Do you think his talents were wasted in Alien 3?
He was in Alien 3? I guess so.
There's your answer, people. I saw it like two or three nights ago, and I said, "Okay, there he is." Yeah, he was not a major character. He was kind of a minor character, but he had force to what his minor role was. So
yeah.
I thought it was kind of a small role for him that he was capable of more. So
were there any movies with black characters that you particularly identified with as a younger person? Or you just said, yeah, that's me.
That is a good question. And I have to think about it. Such a good question. Movies.
It could have been a TV show, or I don't know.
I mean, it's a cliche. It'll be a cliche. I mean, I could say The Cosby Show, but everyone mm-hmm. would say The Cosby Show from a certain generation.
I can remember when I was entry-level corporate wearing Nordstrom ties, and I was like, oh my God, this is the first time I've seen a family that resembles my family. And they said, oh no, that's not realistic. That's not portraying what black people are really like. And I'm like, of course it does. That's exactly what goes on in my house. When I first moved to New York, Brooklyn, in the early 90s, mm-hmm. I was really big into this black cultural production thing because I had done, you know, the California yuppie thing. Right. And I said, well, let's see what's going on in New York City and stuff like that.
Right.
And I had the good fortune to meet probably the premier black film critic, Elvis Mitchell.
Uh-huh.
A friend of mine knew Elvis personally, and we hung out sometimes, and we just started talking about movies. Right. And it's just a crazy thing to know or hear their perspective on not only the quality of the film, but the people behind it and how films get built and how they're made. And that was a very cool guy, Elvis mm-hmm. Mitchell, and he's still around. I'm pretty sure he's still, mentoring younger folks in the industry. I don't know if he's still on the East Coast or back over here. And so any of our listeners who want to know more about film, definitely check out Elvis Mitchell. He used to do a show on NPR called The Treatment, but I'm sure he has his. I heard a little bit of echo.
Michael lives in LA, and we're just talking stuff. I think she's busy. I can't confirm.
All right. Well, that's quite all right.
Yeah.
Next time, we'll just have to say we have a special guest today in the studio, and then we'll have to.
She's going to surprise me. Are you going to surprise?
Uh-oh,
me?
Oh.
Come here.
Hello.
Here we go.
No.
There you go.
All right. So you have to get to tell me a little bit about what you think about the following movies. Get Out, Us, Nope, and Schmigadoon.
The only one of those I've seen is Get Out, so.
And what'd you think?
It was cute.
It was cute. All right. I use that word a lot when I watch certain films. So I was thinking about black directors, and I really like Antoine Fuqua.
I'm sorry, I don't follow these things. I don't know names.
You mean the movies? Yeah. Right.
Oh, okay.
We're not culturally attuned.
Return of the Titans. She loves Return of the Titans.
Oh, Return of the yeah. Remember the Titans. Remember the Titans was a great one.
I feel like I'm not sorry. I was probably not, but a black director.
How about Hidden Figures? Did you like Hidden Figures?
It's very much. Women Empowerment. Yep. I liked Hidden Figures. And I liked Get Out. I stayed cute because I knew it was supposed to be kind of a thriller, and luckily I wasn't that scared by it. So I don't usually love thrillers.
All right. Final question. Sorry to Bother You.
I have no idea what that is. Are you apologizing to me?
Sorry.
No.
Thank you. I don't pay the movies much, though.
Oh, okay.
indulged, don't we? Oh, we're seeing American Fiction. We are going to see American Fiction again.
That if you're not...
We're actually discussing it at my book group today. That was because I recommended it to the book group. So I'm going to return you to Waif, though.
All right.
All right.
Like it's my book group. Okay.
You said that I'm That's true. Like,
So I would say my favorite new black actor is Lakeith Stanfield.
Okay.
And he did Sorry to Bother You.
Huh?
But he also did a series recently. And it was called, oh, come on, The Changeling.
Oh, okay. I heard of that.
This was a TV series. Absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely brilliant. It's one of the more deep storytelling films with black actors that is not making it a race film at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, these characters, they feel like people you know.
Right.
They feel like cousins of yours.
Yes.
And you're just like, oh, I know this person. And then they develop and you see different things about them. And every once in a while, there is a little bit of magic that happens when you get the right actors, the right story, and the right vehicle, and just something transformative happens. That's not only universal, it doesn't necessarily have to be that, but it's just transcendent in that it gets to you.
I agree.
And you say, oh my goodness.
I so agree. And that's how I felt. You already know this. That's how I felt when I saw American Fiction for the first time. I just felt, this gets me. I can see myself and cousins in this thing. I didn't feel that way when I saw Training Days with Denzel Washington. But I also saw a part of myself of my aunts and uncles and grandparents in A Raisin in the Sun, because that was their generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I could hear, you know, things like, you know, in my house there is a God, or you know, no profanity in this house, or
absolutely
of considering destroying a war trial. Those are things I recognize. And so, you know, the thing is, Michael, you know, I am not the typical cohort for the Black American market. So my expectations are very low, in a sense. I don't expect to see myself in front of
I understand. I understand. And it's very hard. It's the same thing as being a jazz fan. Mm. I mean, if you're really, truly a jazz fan or a classical fan, you know, 85% of the people are not even going to know what you're talking about.
And
much less say, okay, well, that's really you. Right. And I can see why that moves you.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm just, the interesting thing is I'm just learning to play piano. Something that I've always wanted to play, now I know it's BWV 846, and that's a prelude in C major by Bach. And
nice, I love Bach.
It's
by the way.
Simple, but it's beautiful, and it's a lot more complex than you would think. And when I'm listening to my own favorite pianist play it, they do it in a different way. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna do the beginner thing like that.
How much practice the piano? Have you started?
I have started to discipline myself to practice the piano enough so that I get on my own nerves. So I am starting to finally figure out why it is that people have quit playing piano. because I get to the point where I play something for like 45 minutes and I'm really getting it. And this is like from scratch. It's brand new. And it's just like, if you practice for another hour and a half, you would master this.
Yeah.
And I could see someone hitting me on the knuckles with a ruler when I fat finger a B flat. So that's where I am where I'm like, yeah. Oh yeah, okay, now I really believe that I can do this, yeah. But yeah. It's, I know how badly I suck, so.
Yeah, yeah, and it's totally in your control. Like when I learned to play the piano as a little kid, I just was drawn to it. I loved to do it for fun. I enjoyed the challenge. And so I would practice 2-3 hours a day, just without giving a second thought, just because I enjoyed the sounds and the melodies and the songs so much. So I have a little bit of the musician in me, definitely.
So let's close out with some of my favorites. Why your favorites, Mike?
Inquiry minds want to know.
Because these are some of the movies that I would say are the best black movies that I've seen. So right up top comes Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust.
Okay.
Which is it's David Lean quality cinematic beauty. Mm-hmm. It's just that beautiful. And the next one is the one that was the feel good, warmed my heart movie that I just said, oh, this is so beautiful. And that was Antoine Fisher. And Antoine Fisher was Denzel Washington's directorial debut. Mm-hmm. And that was really good. And then I'm going to close off with, there's others. Finding Forrester. Mm-hmm. Such a cool movie. Such mm-hmm. a cool movie mm-hmm. with young people in it. And you're like, okay, all the right. young people aren't going to be there. We're going to be okay with mm-hmm. the next generation. And mm-hmm. that was great. But just a classic. Just a classic is Deep Cover. Do you remember Deep Cover?
No, sorry.
Oh my God. No, it's a great one. That is a great one with Lawrence Fishburne.
Sure.
And sure. That was a classic 90s.
Oh, Michael, I'm so glad you jarred my memory. Thank you so much. I was thinking, I am so pathetic that I just can't think of a black movie like my wife can, rattle them all. You know what movie really got me in the 1990s that I really love to watch? I maybe two or three times. Actually, two movies, now that I think about it. Thank you, Michael, for bringing back the recollections. New Jack City.
Oh, yes.
And I lived in
a cult classic. You have to see New Jack City.
You have to see it. That's right. And then Boys in the Hood, which I saw several times. You may have a different perspective on Boys in the Hood, having grown up in L.A., but coming from small town Virginia, it just seemed very exotic.
Yes. I have to admit, this is one of those movies that I just hated with a passion.
Really?
Not because the movie was bad. If you're Catholic, you understand something called the sins of omission.
Yes.
So that's what the Boys in the Hood was like, because it was filmed like that one and White Man Can't Jump.
Yeah.
Were filmed in Los Angeles black neighborhoods where they had to cut it just so you wouldn't see the upscale places.
Are you serious?
I am dead serious. I am dead serious. Anybody who grew up in my part of L.A., knows what they did to do that. Because Crenshaw is like right next to one of the wealthiest black communities.
Baldwin Hills.
In the country. Yeah, Baldwin Hills, View Park, Windsor Hills, that area. So I think it was the last scene where somebody pulls up in a mall parking lot in a lowrider they get shot.
Right.
That is the foot of Stalker. And you have to cut out the rest of the hill behind it, because in the hill are all the million-dollar houses that would be plain to see. Plain to see. And
You ruined my memory, Michael.
I'm sorry.
You ruined.
The second part of this story is my little bourgeois tale of me kind of finally getting over it.
Right.
Because I went to a Labor Day party on Martha's Vineyard, mm-hmm. which is the white party, yeah. as you would know.
Yes.
And guess who's in on the avenue in the ice cream parlor but John Singleton, the director of this movie.
Right.
And I only found him because I was following one of the female actresses from the Cosby Show spinoff at the at the college. What was that?
What's it called? Not Different Strokes. I should know. I can't. I know it, but I can't put my tongue on.
Yes. So I was. What?
Different World. Is that it?
Different World. That's right. Different World.
Got it.
And I was following the not Lisa Bonet, but the other character.
Oh, Jasmine something?
Yay. Yes.
Okay. Man, you're really testing my knowledge of movies here.
Don Lewis.
Okay.
Of course I had a crush on Don Lewis. Who wouldn't?
Of course. Yeah, right.
So Don Lewis was on the avenue and walking into this ice cream shop, and she went in and went out, and I went in, and there is John Singleton, and I'm like, oh, I want to say something so bad. But I maintained my cool, and I said, that's okay.
And Michael, I feel your angst because you can only imagine how many billions of people on the planet have this image of Crenshaw based on that movie.
Oh, right. Oh, for sure. I know. That's what I hated because, you know, I have a couple Los Angeles writers whose work I love, Jervy Tervelon and the late Wanda Coleman, who was kind of the poet laureate of Los Angeles. And right. I'm like, how, you know, John Singleton, he went to USC film school. Can't hold that against him. He's going to have Hollywood connections. He makes a blockbuster film.
Mm-hmm.
What can you do? What can you do? So I said, I'm not gonna be a hater.
Right.
I dare you to read my review, bitch.
I'm assuming that you're not alone. That other people who live in that neighborhood felt the same way.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
All of my friends in the Lynx, and Jack and Jill, they wouldn't hear of it. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's a bigger world now. And there's more of us who are successful, and that's why we can have films like Soul Plane, and we can have American Fiction. And isn't that interesting? Because maybe that's part of John Singleton's story.
Maybe
he was just like Jeffrey Wright's character, Ellison Monk Ellison, and just said, you know, this is how I'm going to get paid. And nobody's going to follow me unless I get paid.
This is how I'm going to get paid. Well, you know, Walter Younger wanted to get paid. He wanted that $10,000 check so badly.
I guess there's a common thread here.
There's a common thread.
In American, the American dream.
Even in New Jack City. Just kind of paid.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
What is that song? There's a song that starts the soundtrack for the money. Living for the city. But yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that should be like our little soundtrack for this one. Living.
Wesley Snipes, Ice-T.
That was
Alan Payne.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's horrible.
Another little interesting footnote coincidence. So who's the actor? Ice-T, right, in that movie? Mm-hmm. So Ice-T actually resembles my father-in-law, which is kind of interesting.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Did he have the pencil mustache like Adolf Caesar?
Did he? He had a mustache. It wasn't pencil. He had a mustache, though.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. So interesting. So yeah, wow. So we got the sergeant with the Twyman uncles, and we've got Ice-T with the father-in-law. So there are shades of us in the movies.
Excellent, excellent. Well, this has been great fun. My goodness.
Yes, wonderful. You pulled out a lot of me. Thank you very much, Michael, because I really was not pulling out very much at the start. Although,
well, we all love me.
I'm sincere, though. I do love Kelly. I do love Kelly in that episode from Black Mirror, season 3, episode 4. That is, I love that character.
I like the guy that holds the mirror, the shard to his neck.
Ooh, okay.
I think he was really good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So.
Well, my good man, I hope you have a good weekend.
I hope you have
this has
too.
Been fun.
It's been always fun.
It's been nice to throw back some free thoughts back and forth.
True. That is true. Although, you know, the thing is, I mean, this is episode 5.
Five. Yeah. Yes.
What are you thinking about 6? I mean, where's your mind going?
Oh,
where's
goodness.
Earth? Yeah, I know. So we've covered the gambit. There's always woke kindergarten. There's what else is there?
One of the things that we didn't really cover was I have some African filmmakers here.
Oh, really?
So Ousmane Sembène and Haile Gerima. Well, I don't think Haile Gerima was African, but maybe we should take that tangent of the Black American, the Black UK, the Black African connections. Mm-hmm. What happened with Pan-Africanism? What were our expectations of it then versus now? And how strong are those links?
That's a thought.
That's one off the top of my head.
One of many. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll come up with some, and maybe we'll get some people to comment about things that you'd like us to talk about.
There you go. That's a good idea.
All right. And remember, a free Compt's subscription to the Journal of Free Black Thought for 1 year. If you can name which episode, which is probably easy, consider this only been 5. All right, my man.
All right. Take
care.
You too. Bye-bye.